Hello, today is Wednesday, December the 11th, 1996. My name's Earl Chess. I'm an alcoholic. I invite you to listen to the 1996 Men's Home Fund. Thank you. It's Alexandria, Virginia. And thank you, and I hope you like this tape.
Welcome, everybody, to the Men's Home Christmas Celebration. My name is Mary, and I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. I want to thank each and every one of you for participating in this evening. It's a wonderful way to celebrate our sobriety and how we share with each other, and that sort of sharing is what helps make this men's home a success. I think that we should all give ourselves a round of applause. Yeah. I also like to mention a few names, and I won't mention all the names. I'll miss some, so I apologize in advance. But one person I think you should know who's worked very hard to make this evening a success is our cook, Keith Keister. So let's all say hello. He's back there doing KP, but he heard you, I can see. Keith will tell you that he got a lot of help, and surely he did. A lot of the volunteers that helped out with this evening are people we really appreciate. I'm not going to mention all the names, but you know who you are, and your peers know who you are, too. And thank you very much, because this is a very important place in sobriety. It was one of the first places that I came here when I was early in sobriety, and I am very grateful for the opportunity to serve the home. But enough about me. We have a great speaker here today. His name is Carlton C., and I will turn it over to Carlton, and the best thing about this is there's no halftime, so you don't have to get to your wallets again. Carlton? Thank you.
Hi, everybody. My name's Carlton. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Carlton.
How you doing, family? All my brothers and sisters in sobriety. What a beautiful family it is, too. I'll tell you that. There's not a better family that I could be a part of. I can assure you that. When I say I'm an alcoholic, I need to tell you right off, it's not my fault. It's my mother's fault. I have a birth defect. I was born a quart low. And I know that to be true because when I drink a quart of whiskey, I become irresistible. And my first sponsor, and I've only had two, my first sponsor was a guy named Buck Doyle. And when I told him that, thinking I was being funny, he just unsmilingly said, "Nah, you aren't irresistible, you're irresponsible." And he's right about that, I'll tell you. You know, this is a special time of year, and I'm sure all of you know that you're in a very special place here at the men's home. So special here, in fact, for us alcoholics, I don't think you would be surprised if I told you I know there have been miracle after miracle after miracle happen right under this roof. And I think all of us in Alcoholics Anonymous experience the miracle of sobriety. If you think that's too grand and too expansive a word, I invite you to look it up in the dictionary and see if it fits you. You might be surprised because, strangely enough, a dictionary is part of what I use in my sobriety. Why do I use a dictionary? I went to school, and you know, I have a fairly decent vocabulary, but I like to know exactly what the big book and the 12 and 12 are talking about. And so I use it a lot, especially when doing inventories and things like that. It's this time of year that one of my favorite alcoholic recovery stories is about a miracle. And the story is really about a little 5-year-old boy. He wasn't an alcoholic. But he was asked about this time of year, what would you like for a Christmas gift? And being 5 years old, he had friends who already had tricycles. He said, I'd like a brand new red tricycle. So his parents said, we'll see what we can do. And guess what? Christmas morning, he came down the steps, and sitting under the Christmas tree was a brand new bright red tricycle. Oh, boy. Now, it was one of those warm December days like we can have around here, and out he went with his brand new tricycle, and he lived on a long hill that had a nice sidewalk to test it out. So he hopped on that tricycle and started down the hill, and he was looking at the sidewalk, he was looking at his feet, and he quickly discovered, some of us who've had tricycles discover, because as you pick up speed going downhill, if you take your feet off the pedals, you can go even faster, can't you? But the bad news is, once you get going faster, you can't put your feet back on the pedals because they're spinning too quickly, and there are no brakes on that Hummer, are there? Well, he was watching his feet going ever faster and the pedals going around. He happened to look up, and he was just about to run up the backside of the preacher from his church. Well, what to do? Nothing to do but to swerve off the sidewalk, and he slammed into the ditch, and his knee came up and hit the handlebar. And he said something he had heard his father say. He said, son of a bitch. Well, the preacher heard this and turned around and came back to the little boy lying in the ditch with a tricycle. And he said, son, when painful things happen in our lives, if you want something good to come of it, just say, praise the Lord. The little boy acknowledged, didn't say anything. Preacher went on down the street, boy back on the tricycle, started down the hill again. Temptation overtook him. He took his feet off the pedals a second time. And he looked up, and the same event was about to happen again. He was about to hit the preacher right on the back of the knees. He didn't want to do that, so he swerved off the pathway. But this time, he hit a telephone pole. Wham! And bent the front wheel of that tricycle double. Now, the preacher heard all this commotion. And he turned to see what the little boy would do, and the little boy, sure enough, remembered. He said, praise the Lord. And with that front wheel straightened right back out. And the preacher saw that. What do you think he said? Son of a bitch. So if you don't believe in miracles, try to believe. Because we have miracles every day in Alcoholics Anonymous. January the 5th, 1973, was a Friday. I had been confronted 2 days before that by my boss over in Bethesda. When he came in my office and said, Carlton, I think you got a drinking problem. What do you think? And strangely enough, I said, I think you're right, boss. He said, here's a scrap of paper. I want you to go downtown and see this doctor, Dr. Earl Mitchell. And I want you to listen to him, and I want you to do what he says. So on that Friday, January the 5th, 1973, I went to see Earl Mitchell down on Q Street. He took my blood pressure. He looked at my hands. Didn't have a lot to say. He kept me waiting a long time, maybe 3, 4, 5 minutes in the waiting room, which was not very fair to find a guy like me. But he sent me away with three things. He sent me away with a book I don't see on our bookshelves anymore called Marty Mann's Primer on Alcoholism, written by a wonderful woman. He sent me away with those 12 or 20 questions, I can't remember which it was now, and he sent me away with a scrap of paper with Buck D's name and phone number on it. My instructions were simple. Said, I want you to take this simple 12 or 20 question test, answer it honestly if you can, and then I'd like you to try to read some things from that book. Now, I like to take tests. When I get Reader's Digest, I go right to the word power, the 20 questions. I always try to score, 20. I've only aced it once. So I went down that alcoholic test, yes, 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 and a couple of no's. Do you ever miss work because of your drinking? Well, the answer is obviously no. I always showed up at the office, drunk as heck, shaking, try to get through a little coffee, begin to manipulate so I'd be out drinking martinis at lunch. I missed a lot of work. I couldn't sign checks, you know, that kind of stuff. So I got to the end of that, and, you know, it has that instant gratification. As soon as you finish the test, it gives you results. It said, if you've answered three or more of these, yes, you probably have a serious drinking problem. Maybe you're an alcoholic. Well, armed with that new information, I went to the kitchen, got my half gallon of Kentucky Gentleman out, and began drinking. Now, by that time, I was a daily blackout drinker. I was drinking approximately a half gallon of whiskey a day, bourbon. How do I know that? Because I paid for my whiskey by check. I went to the thrifty stores in Washington and up in northeast, northwest Washington. Every Thursday, they have sales on Thursday. You could buy a case of half gallons for about $8 a half gallon. By that time, I was buying, you know, the bounce to the ounce. I wanted the most firepower for the least dollars. And I was drinking that myself. I wasn't letting anybody else have any of that. And so I got blackout drunk that Friday night. That was the last drink I have had to this day. Saturday, I didn't drink. I began reading Marty Mann's Primer on Alcoholism. Now, that doesn't sound like much, but by that time, with daily blackout drinking, I could not read a two-page article in Reader's Digest and tell you what I had read on the first page when I got to the second page. My brain was fried. But magically and unknowingly, this was one of my first miracles in sobriety. I read Marty Mann's Primer on Alcoholism that Saturday. It's a book about the size of our big book. Nice big print, easy to read, even when you got the shakes and sweats. And I finished that book, and I discovered some things, the very beginnings. And if I could just pick one word that would describe what I found in that book, it was hope. Hope. I discovered that I was not too different from a lot of other people in the world, alcoholics, and there was a way out. I didn't drink Saturday. Sunday, I finally got up the courage to do the third thing. I picked up that scrap of paper with Buck D's name on it, called him. I didn't know him. He didn't know me. And described why I was calling him. He said, I want you to come over to my house Monday night. He gave me an address in Arlington. And he asked me some rather unusual questions. I thought, he said, can you drive? I said, yes. Do you have a car? Yes. Does it run? He asked. Yes. Does it have valid license plates on it? Yes. Do you have a driver's license? Yes. Is it valid? Yes. Now, I hadn't been questioned like that, but with that gruff voice, there seemed to be something contagious in the way he was questioning me. I wasn't offended by it. I was drawn to it. That Monday night, I showed up on his doorstep about 7:30. He and his wife, Dolly, put me in a car. They took me to Foxhall. I went down those steps to the old church at Foxhall. I was dressed very much like I am now, business wear, not knowing what this thing Alcoholics Anonymous was, having no idea. I had never, ever tried to stop drinking, ever, for any reason. Never occurred to me to stop drinking. And just like going into a new saloon, a new bar, as he went on down the steps and across to the coffee pot, I stepped to the right and leaned against the wall to check out you guys. Now, he didn't see me stop. He got all the way across to the coffee pot. He turned, saw me standing across the room, and in his loud, booming voice, he said to some of his friends, hey, I got a new one with me here tonight. Well, I want to tell you, my deodorant failed right then, folks. And you know how sensitive we drunks are. He sensed my discomfort right away, came over, grabbed me, brought me up to the front row, and said, why don't you have a seat here? I'll come sit with you in a few minutes. You want some coffee? No, I don't want any coffee. So Dolly stayed in the back. He sat beside me that night. Now, I can't tell you whether there were two men, two women, or one of each that spoke that night, but I can tell you that that spark of hope that had been struck on Saturday reading Marty Mann's Primer began to get the fuel of alcoholic recovery love that night. Now, I couldn't have told you that night. But I can tell you I had a strange physical sensation sitting on the front row. I was very aware of my facial muscles. Why? Because I was smiling. I hadn't smiled in about a year and a half. I don't think I had smiled at all. And you all were telling these tragic tales and laughing. And I found myself after about 15 minutes laughing with you. It was wonderful. And as we left there that Monday night and came back across Key Bridge and came into Roslyn, we stopped at a stoplight. There was a bright street light above us. I was in the front seat in the passenger side. He was driving. He turned to me. I mean, really turned to me, looked at me squarely. He said, "Carlton, I want to make you a promise." "It's not my promise," said he, "it's AA's promise." He said, "If you will embrace," and that's the verb he used, "if you will embrace the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, we promise you, we promise everybody in this program the joy of living." My goodness, what in the world did he mean by that? I thought he was saying, if you buy one of those big books we're selling and read it and go to some meetings, you're going to be happy the rest of your life. And you know, that's not too far off the mark. But what he was sharing with me was a promise much more profound. What he was saying to me is, "Carlton," and you remember I was irresistible when I drank, if I knew what embrace meant. He said, "If you will put your arms around the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, our 12 steps, and bring them into your life, you will experience the joy of living." That's not for some of us, not for boys, for girls, it's for all of us. All of us receive that promise. Now that began a journey for me that I hope we're all on together tonight. A journey we're all invited to take. And if you haven't heard it put that way, let me suggest it this way. We're all asked, and even some of us ask ourselves, two basic questions, and perhaps others, but all of us are asked two. The first I was asked, "Carlton, are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober?" That's a yes or no question. Not maybe, sometimes, what do you mean, none of that. That's a yes or no question. And I can answer that one day at a time. And my answer was yes. I am scared. I have a lot of fear in me. I've been confronted by my boss. That was my motivating force in the AA. The second question we're all asked, and sometimes asked a little later on, "Carlton, are you willing to grow along spiritual lines?" Well, when I first heard that, being a good drunk, I knew how to answer that. I said, "Well, what do you mean by that?" You don't want to answer a question, you ask one back, right? And don't we always get the loving answer in AA, and I did. "Carlton, why don't you keep coming to meetings until you understand what we mean by that?" And so I continue to do that today, to come to meetings to find out what you mean by growing along spiritual lines. In many of our meetings, as we begin our meetings, we read from the big book, How It Works. And we get down to the end of the part most of our meetings read, the ABCs of staying sober, the ABCs. A, I'm an alcoholic. My life is unmanageable. B, probably no human power can relieve my alcoholism. That's certainly true for me. My wife couldn't do it. My parents couldn't do it. My boss couldn't do it except by slam dunking me. And then the C of that, the C, God could and would do what? Relieve my alcoholism if he were sought. Think about that. God could and would relieve my alcoholism if he were sought. It doesn't even say I have to find him, does it? I don't even have to find him. All I have to do is say yes to an invitation to walk a spiritual path. Well, where's the spiritual path? You folks are on it. All I've got to do is join hands with you and do what you do, and I'll get what you've got. Isn't that simple? And so here's this wonderful invitation to walk a spiritual path, to embrace the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know what the principles were. Quickly pointed out to me, 12 steps. Those are the principles on our walls of most of our meeting rooms, 12 steps. Now, if you don't think those 12 steps are a miracle, consider this at least. How many words are in the 12 steps total? 200, exactly 200. Count them, I had to, I didn't trust you. Had to count each step, write it down, you know, 26, 7, 12, whatever it is. Add them up, I could do that by then. But you mean to tell me I can build a whole new way of living, a whole new way of living based on 200 English words? You said, "Yep, sure can, if you will embrace them." What does that mean? That means within my grasp, 24 hours a day, not just at meeting time, at work, at play, with family, with friends, by myself, I have the use of those 200 words. Many of us call them the tools of sobriety. And all I have to be willing to do is become an apprentice. You will teach me how to use those tools. Regular attendance at step meetings will teach me how to use those tools. And then I take them with me. And when I'm confused or don't know how to make them work, I talk to my sponsor or somebody who's already done what I need to do and you give me permission. What do I mean by give me permission? I think a lot of what we do in these meeting rooms is we give each other permission. What's that about? Well, let me suggest this. That first night, that first meeting I went to, you gave me permission to do what? To not drink. How did you give me permission? You didn't come up and say, Carlton, we give you permission to not drink. You said, I don't drink. I don't drink alcohol today. You gave me permission to try it. Wasn't long before I heard people saying, well, you know, to get on a spiritual path, I found it necessary to do some things that really worked for me. You didn't tell me what to do. You said, here's some things that work for me. You gave me permission to try what worked for you. And when I would talk to Buck, my sponsor, about these things and say, I'm confused, I don't understand, he said, don't worry about it. Say, if you forget them, you'll hear them again. But if you think they'll work for you, try them. And so I began to walk on that spiritual path, not alone, with you. How did I come to that Friday confrontation with my boss? I didn't drink in high school. I didn't drink in college. I heard a fellow say that once. He said, I didn't go to high school. I didn't go to college. Well, I did. I was raised not far from here, Richmond, Virginia. Only child. Born in 1935, the same year as AA. It's easy for me to remember. I hear so many people in this beautiful fellowship say they had a lousy childhood. I didn't. I had a great childhood. I had a very devoted mother and father. My mother especially was very interested that I kept my time productively occupied, summer, school time and all. I wasn't allowed to hang around. And she was very concerned about constructive things for me to do. If I had to live my childhood over again, I wouldn't change a thing. Wouldn't change a thing. It was great. I got into scouting and on and on and on. All kinds of things that made me feel good about what was going on in my life. And so it wasn't until I got out of college and went into service and discovered happy hour and began drinking. But it was social drinking. I went to Fort Sill, Oklahoma. A lot of other young folks like us. I was married just before that. And we'd go out and, you know, get a book of coupons at the bar, you know. But I can look back now and say, you know, when a couple would go get a $5 book of coupons and drinks were like 25, 30 cents, I'd get a $10 book of coupons. Why was that? I don't know. I got an idea. Was I expansive in buying drinks for other people? Not so much. No? But that, after a few years, out of the service, now into the regular workforce, the weekend drinking became daily drinking. As my economic circumstances improved, I found myself here in the Washington area. I don't blame it on the Washington area. But we found ourselves in communities where people took a drink every day, and I enjoyed that. And I can now look back and see my behavior was a little exaggerated from our neighbors. Other couples, you know, we were all in the same economic circumstances, not very well off. We couldn't afford to provide everything for everybody, so you brought your own drinks. Most of our neighborhood affairs. Other people would bring a shaker of whiskey sours. I'd bring a half gallon of bourbon and a pencil to mark how far it had gone down. Little different. I'd be the first one there. My wife would come later. I'd be the last one to leave. I like to dance. You know, I'm energetic drunk at that stage. Now, I drank for 15 years, plus or minus a few months. And it's very easy now, with your help, for me to look back. The first 5 years of my drinking were fun for me and fun for those around me. The second 5 years were fun for me. They weren't much fun for those around me because they couldn't quite figure out where I was going with them. The last 5 years, my industrial strength drinking period was not that much fun for me and not fun at all for those around me. Being irresistible when you drink. Marriage is a problem. Was for me, maybe not you. From time to time, you find yourself not sleeping in the big bed. And we had an old burnt orange sofa that became mine. If you remember the 50s, burnt orange. That was it. And the dents that hard nap burnt orange leaves on you will last most of the day. You sleep face down, it'll last through a shave, it'll last up to lunch, I'll tell you that. What happened to you, Carlton? I don't know. Maybe you should see a dermatologist. No, I'll have a drink. But I would be confronted by this wife of mine, and she's a wonderful lady. Don't misunderstand. She's still a fine lady. I'm not married to her anymore, but I take more than 50% of that one, let me tell you. And she would give me simple things to do, and I would get home a little late for dinner, like maybe 2 o'clock in the morning, and she would be upset. And by the way, if you go out drinking and you come home that late, don't come home sober. Think about it. Do not come home sober. And I was getting tired of being chastised, criticized, and, you know, mistaken identity and spousal brutality and all that stuff. And there came a time when I thought, well, I'll just have to do something to get even. And my simple chore this Friday was to bring home bread. Bread. I forgot. And when I got home, where's the bread? And you smell funny and you're acting funny. You're right. I'll go get the bread. Well, by this time, having spent more time down on M Street than back in Annandale, I knew that there was better bread than sliced bread, so I figured I had discovered something called sourdough bread. So I figured I'll get sourdough bread. If I got to go back out, I'll get sourdough bread. Well, where do they make the best sourdough bread? San Francisco. So I drove out to Dulles Airport and went to San Francisco. Well, San Francisco is a great place to drink. Bar on every corner. Live and let live attitude back in the 70s, late 60s, 70s. This was in the early 70s. And so it took me a while to get back with the bread. About 17 months it took to get back. And I forgot the bread. And that's partly true, mostly true, but I did come back a couple of times. Actually, about the same time, our company over in Bethesda won a contract in San Francisco with the Bureau of the Mint. People make your pocket coins. Centennial was coming up, and we were a computer company, and we were going to do some special things for them, for people who collect coins.
Numismatists.
And so I got sent out there, and I finagled it, I manipulated it. You drunks know what I'm talking about. And back I would go, and I would stay weeks or months at a time and come home rarely. Well, being irresistible in San Francisco turned out to be a pretty good deal. And I went through 3 different periods out there. I had my Myrna period, my Ramona period, and my Grace period. Women all, wonderful women. Amazing Grace. And these women, strangely enough, were attracted to this nutty alcoholic. Now, they were smart women. They would go out with me, but they always had an escape route. They would have cab fare or something in their pocket because I was one of those Jekyll and Hyde drunks. I could be a nice guy dancing and getting along fine, and then there's like this big switch in me. I'd turn into a mean, foul-mouthed drunk, and it could happen in a heartbeat. Usually, somebody discovered that there was something about me they didn't like. That's hard for you to imagine, I know. And they would... You ever been rejected? I would be rejected. Now, I'm a sensitive alcoholic. Now, if I was sitting in a bar with a woman and trying to be a silver-tongued devil, you know, and suddenly I would overstep. Any of y'all ever overstepped? I would be rejected. Now, I was sensitive enough, if I were talking to one of you ladies and you told me about what you felt good about, it might be your job, it might be your looks, it might be your family, it might be your car, it might be your boat, something that you really felt good about. When that switch went on to mean and ugly, what would I attack? I'd attack where you felt good about yourself. I'd attack your looks, I'd attack your children, I'd attack your job, I'd attack your... People don't like that. They get upset about that. They get mad, real mad about that. And the only 3 times I was ever arrested were in San Francisco. I was arrested on the same street, the same bar, in the same summer. Now, I knew when I set out to drink that half gallon of whiskey, and I developed a life survival mode by then out there. I would come back from our little work site, I would buy a jar of Planters dry roasted mixed nuts and a half gallon of whiskey. And I'm here to tell you, you can sustain life for 17 months on that. You get your proteins, you get all your basic ingredients out of that jar of Planters dry roasted mixed nuts, I can tell you. I would sit up on the 17th floor of this little apartment we called an office, but nobody ever went to it but me, and I would eat that jar of Planters dry roasted mixed nuts, and I would drink half the half gallon. That's a quart, right? I never got to metric, so that's a quart. Now, you know what happens to me when I drink a quart, with the birth defect being a quart low. I become irresistible. And so I would dress to go out for the evening. I had special attire for drinking. I had a bright red pair of polyester pants with a big wide belt. Some of you remember that. I had a long sleeve flowered shirt. I had a tennis, just a lightweight white tennis jacket. And by then, Myrna had crocheted me a little red beanie, beret, a little thing in the top. And I had some tennis sneakers and socks. And I would go, you talk about irresistible, right, ladies? Catchy, isn't it? Now, these polyester red pants had become frayed on the bottom. And it takes a lot to fray polyester, but they had. And good old Myrna had put flowered trim on the bottom of the pants. It sort of went with this. I mean, that's a picture, isn't it? Now, I always left after drinking a quart. I would go 2 blocks to the west and 3 blocks to the north on Larkin Street. There was a bar there. And the bartender's name was Dennis, weird old Dennis. And I would go on this John Barleycorn, the name of the bar, John Barleycorn. It was a nice neighborhood bar, gas, fireplace, balladeer would come in at about 9 o'clock. And I would sit underneath the television set at the right end of the bar, always had the same stool if it were open. And Dennis would bring over a 12-ounce tumbler of room temperature California Red Burgundy. Now, I don't know if you've ever dumped California Red Burgundy down on a quart of whiskey. But the reason you drink it is not to get drunk, right? Wrong. It made me crazy as hell, I'll tell you. But it enhanced the irresistibility. And I would look down the bar to see if there were any ladies there. And it was a nice neighborhood bar. You use the gals. You always come in twos. That's a problem. Or you come with, they come with an escort. Now, I could never seem to see the escort for some reason. But I would slide down the bar, now armed with all that. And as I mentioned, I was a pretty silver-tongued guy. And I would say something to the lady like, gee, you don't sweat much for a fat lady, do you? Or something like that. And as I mentioned, occasionally I would experience rejection. Now, I would return over and over again, 2 blocks to the west, 3 blocks to the north, all uphill. It's important. It was all uphill to get there. Because coming home was what? Downhill. I knew that was going to be a necessary requirement to get home. The first time I was arrested, I got an AWI. Now, I worked my way through. I was an AWI, BWI, CWI. I was an alphabetized drunk. I got arrested for arguing with the bartender, Dennis. And I wasn't giving up on it, so he called the San Francisco police. And I got arrested for arguing while intoxicated. I argued with the cop. Dennis was one thing, cop was something else. The second time, I had offended one of these women, and we were fighting, and she was winning. As a matter of fact, she had knocked me on the floor without it. She never even stood up. She just went, whop, like that. But the cops came, and so I was arrested for brawling while intoxicated. Brawling while intoxicated. The third time, I was on my downhill trek home. I'd been rejected. I hadn't been thrown out. But I'd experienced something that I knew would happen to me from time to time. I occasionally would experience what I call a penguin syndrome. Now, if you don't know what I'm talking about, when you stand up after drinking a lot, your feet go out like this, and you just fall flat on your face. Now, I could use the bar and the furniture to sort of get to the door, but then I knew I could not walk home. It was only 5 blocks home. I only had to get through 4 intersections, and so I began crawling home. I was arrested for crawling while intoxicated. I did not have a car. That's an unknown blessing until I came in AA. I didn't have a car up there. Now, does the police blotter say A-W-I-B-W-I-C-W-I? No. What does it say? It says common drunk. Common drunk. And the longest I stayed in jail was a Memorial Day weekend, 4 days, 3 nights. That doesn't sound like much, but it was a lusty weekend. I had a date with Myrna. She and another couple and I had rented a sailboat to sail out of Tiburon. We were going to spend the whole Memorial Day weekend sailing San Francisco Bay, Angel Island, all that stuff. Great weekend, all laid out. I went out Friday night to John Barleycorn. I didn't go sailing, nor did they come get me. And so that was an enormous resentment. I'd never had, and it was very inexpensive to get out of the drunk tank by today's standards, $25 cash, you could get out. I didn't have it. Because one of the things I would do when I went out drinking, I would strip my body of all ID and just put enough cash in my pocket that I knew I could come home without. So I was planning to get drunk, planning to get in some kind of trouble, and that's what would happen. I like to drink. I like to get drunk. I had mottos for drinking, just like we got mottos in AA. Let's have a toddy. Be somebody. Let's get drunk. Go naked. Throw ice water. You know, on down the line. Can't fly on one wing. You know how it goes. All that stuff. And so when I came back from that 17 months, my wife was there. I didn't have the bread. And she had an attorney. I had a lawyer. And if you ladies ever need a really good divorce lawyer, I'll introduce you to my ex-wife's divorce lawyer. She's in Springfield. She's dynamite. 18-page settlement agreement. Clean your clock. I got no complaints. You know, my wife said, "What do you want?" I said, "Nothing." She said, "I'll take care of it." I did better than that. Actually did better than that for the next few years. I got no resentments for that. I will tell you, the end of that tale is after I had been sober 5 years and we had children, still do, I was talking to my ex-wife about the kids, and she had been to some Al-Anon meetings before I came in AA, and after 5 years, she very lovingly, in a stern voice, one day on the phone said, "Hey, I know you're in AA, you've been in AA 5 years, when are you going to make amends to me?" Well, you know, being a gentle soul, I cursed at her and slammed the phone down and said, "The hell with that." But you know, this program has a funny way of grabbing us. I said, "Well, you know, I'll get over that." I didn't get over that. I couldn't deal. It was something about it kept nagging at me. Have I made amends? Sure, I made amends. I've been making the child support payments, doing all that stuff, take the kids out, send them to camp in the summer. I've done everything. Now, I don't know. I didn't talk to my sponsor about it, but it occurred to me to go back and read the 12 and 12 in the big book. Read the fifth step. Having reread the fifth step, I said, you know, I ought to do a fourth step. I ought to do an inventory of my relationship with that woman. And I did, and you know, I discovered there are several things that I had never talked to her about. That I deeply regretted. Things I had not done more than anything else. I wasn't there when I was supposed to have been. I should have been. And so I scheduled a get-together with her, and I took this little one-page inventory of just her relationship of mine and told her about these things I deeply regretted. And you notice I chose that word very carefully. I didn't say right, I didn't say wrong, I didn't say good, I didn't say bad. These were things that lived inside of me that caused me to regret the things in the past. And I went down my list with this woman and told her that I deeply regretted not being here for this and not doing that. And you know what she said on each one of those? She said, "I thought you didn't remember, I thought you didn't care." And I cared very deeply. She cried, I cried, it was a healing experience. Is our relationship perfect today? No. Is it better? You bet. Lots better. When she calls on the phone today to talk now about our granddaughter, who's now 4, I'm anxious to hear what she has to say. I don't have those feelings of fear and anger and resentment when I hear my ex-wife's voice. I'm happy to hear from her. I don't hear from her often, but the healing power of this program is enormous. enormous. And so when I was confronted and came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I began this spiritual journey that we're all on. ABCs, we talked about that. God could and would relieve my alcoholism if he were sought. Now, how to seek God? How do you do that? How do I do that? And as I look at the steps, my eyes, when I think about that particular challenge, are drawn where? To the 11th step. What's the first word in the 11th step? Sought. There it is. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God's understanding. You think about those very powerful but simple words. There's a mystery even embedded in them to me, and you're helping me to understand the mystery. Sought through prayer and meditation, that tells me how to seek my higher power. I pray, I meditate. How do I do it? Well, I learn from how you do it. My now sponsor helps me a lot in learning how particularly to meditate. I have that restless disposition we hear about in AA. I have trouble with that. How to do that? Sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God. Wait a minute. I had no burning bush. It says improve my conscious contact. To me, that means I'm awake. There's contact. Something has happened in my life to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand. And it took me 2 years, I'm embarrassed to tell you, to realize where my conscious contact with God was. It's with you. God speaks to me through you folks in Alcoholics Anonymous. Has been all along, ever since that first night at Foxhall. So if I want to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand him, I keep going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And God will speak to me. And for that simple but powerful reason, you will hear in Alcoholics Anonymous, there are no big deals in AA. No big deals in AA. I don't agree. I do not agree. If my God is speaking to me through you, what does that make each one of you? A big deal to me. Each one of you is a big deal to me because you continue to give me permission to do what you do, to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand. Now, my understanding of my higher power has changed over and over again on this spiritual journey. As I mentioned, meditation has been a challenge for me. With my restless disposition, if I sit down and I got a book or two on meditation, it says do this and do that, that lasts about 20 seconds. That's long for me. I can take a phrase out of the Bible, I can take a phrase out of the 24-hour book, I can take a phrase out of reflections or any of that and try to dwell on this. I wonder if I balance my checkbook. Did I take the garbage out? I could go tie up the newspapers, you know, if they come pick them up on Thursday. I could take them out tonight, but it's raining tonight. And I'm not kidding. That's the way my mind goes. The boop, the boop, the boop. If you're ever thrown a flat rock on a lake, it goes boop, 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 boop. That's the way my mind. I got a flat rock mind. And it can get a lot of bounces before it stops. But I tell you, this program, the permission was given me, some friends of mine said, well, you'd like to be out of doors. Why don't you just take a nice brisk walk beside by yourself? And now I have a 2-mile walk in my neighborhood. I don't have to think which way I'm going. It takes me 29 minutes to walk 2 miles, 4 miles an hour. It's a brisk walk, almost a march step, like that. Now when I leave home, I've got these thoughts banging around in this old brain box of mine. And all I can tell you is when I get home, I have better thoughts than when I left home. That's all I can tell you. To me, that's my meditation. Many times the things that are on my mind when I step outside the door, I'm trying to decide, what should I do about that? What should I do about that? When I get home, many times the answer is, it's none of your business. Leave it alone. Meditation for me. But now I find other things that create an awareness of my higher power. Many of us enjoy the outdoors. Enjoy the outdoors. One of the things I have begun doing for the last 5 years, I'm a National Park Service volunteer. I go away for 3-4 months at a time and be a volunteer in a national park. Live, work in a national park. It's a wonderful experience. Learned a lot about history and Native Americans and their spirituality. It's been a wonderful journey in itself. And the more I learn about other people's ways of thinking and their spirituality, the more I find we all have the same things in common. We just use different vocabularies. And that's helped me with my meditation. Now, can I go into a national park and sit on a rock and look at the river and be still? Now, still flat rock. I can go down the river and throw the flat rock, see how far I can skip it. You know, I said, there I go. But at least I know what's going on. But now there's me and there's me. And I can see me. Thanks to your help. I can sit still and see me. And you know, like that old cigar ad, he's doing it again. He's doing it again. And I'll say, wait a minute, let's don't do that. And so now for this spiritual journey, as part of that prayer and meditation, in the morning, I have this strange feeling that as I come back after my walk, I reflect for a moment and begin to think about my day. It's almost if there's a knock at the door. And I say, who is it? In my mind. And this voice says, it's God. I say, oh, hi. What do you want? I ask him. He says, well, I thought you might want to come and go with me today. Being a good drunk, I said, well, what are we going to do? He says, trust me. Where are we going to go? I ask him. He says, trust me. And I think about that. And most days I say, okay. And I get ready to go with my higher power. But I always say, well, wait a minute. Before I leave, let me get my character defects. I never leave home without them. And my alcoholic higher power says, okay, go get them. And as I come to the door with them in my hand, these big cinder blocks called character defects, you know, I'm lugging those big Hummers along. I know what they are. I've done a 4-step several times. I've done a lot of 10 steps because I need to. You know what my higher power says? He says, why don't you give them to me? God says, give them to me. I'll carry them today. And I say, well, wait a minute. My hands are going to be empty. What am I going to do with my hands? And God just says simply, why don't you hold on with me? Hold on to me with one of your hands. And that'll leave one free all day long. You can help another suffering alcoholic. Now, that sounds sort of goofy. But to me, it's a powerful image. And if I can do that for my waking hours, if I can go through my day giving my character defects to God, they haven't been eliminated, have they? They have been, and the word in the 12-step is removed. They've been removed. There is distance between me and my character defects. And they're in God's hands. I can go get them. Sure, I can stump my toe. I say, whoop, give me that one. There's some greed here. I could deal with some greed today. I might be able to make another nickel. God said, okay, here it is. And I can take it. Now, I would like to tell you that I walked down that spiritual path all day, and it's a perfect day. Now, I don't know about your spiritual path, but my spiritual path has crossroads in it. It has big signposts. It says God's way and Carlton's way. And I come to that, and I look up there, and God's way, yeah, that's sort of narrow down there. Oh, look, down there, Carlton's way, there's music and women, and he's irresistible. He might as well go on down that way. And I start down Carlton's way, and you know what happens? I get into the swamp as I go over the hill. There I am in my old swamp. And I come back, and guess who's waiting there? God, my higher power. He said, you did it again, but come on, I got your character defects, and we'll head on down the road. And I can tell you that that choice is still there for me on a daily basis. It really is. And it's what makes me look at that crossroads and deliberate over that decision of my character defects. Even though they're out of my hands, they still influence me. But I will tell you, at many days at the end of the day, I can think back over the day, do my little days in inventory, and my character defects have not come into play that whole day, a whole day. And the promise that you made me that I could live a day at a time with my character defects removed, not eliminated, removed, has come true. You have made me another fulfilled promise. And to me, that's pretty much the best this alcoholic, can ask for, is to get a day without my character defects coming into play and having my hands free to fulfill the legacy of our triangle. The legacy of our triangle: unity, service, and recovery. It all begins with that foundation of recovery. To thine own self be true. Most of us have a medallion or a coin in our pocket, and how powerful a little message is on there. You didn't get it, you earned it by the grace of God. And I can't do good service work if I am being consumed by my character defects. I don't feel as much of the unity of AA if my character defects are in play. So my life has to begin with recovery. Then I can begin to be a part of the unity and the service. And so if you are thinking about balance, think of the many images we have in AA, and that is a powerful one, an equilateral triangle, all equal on all sides. And so that's a very important image to me. One of the things that has been very important to me, and I've had to try to understand it from you all, is why are we so intent on the new person that comes in Alcoholics Anonymous? Why do we say to them, you're the most important person in the room? And if any of you are sort of new, let me tell you a story that I think will make it clear. It certainly is one of my favorite stories. It's a story about a man who was a young man and finishing his regular school, and he decided he wanted to go to seminary, he wanted to be a missionary. So off he went. He completed his missionary studies, and the masters there at the university said, what do you want to do with your life? He said, well, I would like to be posted in a far distant group of islands in the South Pacific where no one of our order has ever been posted. And they thought about it and said, all right, we'll let you go there. You'll be the first of us to ever go there. And off he went, this group of small islands in the distant South Pacific. And he began his life of service. And the islanders came to love him and he them. One of those islanders became his most trusted servant, beside him almost all the hours of every day. Now, as this missionary reached his later years, his older life, deep in his heart felt that, gee, I would like to return to the land of my childhood for whatever time I have left. The islanders understood. They loved their islands. They loved their land that they had been born on. And so, regretfully, they understood that he would return to his home. Now, the supply ship that would take him away came only twice a year, and they knew about when it would come. And so a week or so before the ship was to arrive, these islanders, not sadly but joyfully, began this grand celebration to say in their loving way, thank you for spending so much of your life with us. As the celebration went on for 2 or 3 days, this man of the cloth suddenly realized his most trusted servant, this islander, had been missing. He hadn't seen him for several days. Where would he be at this last moment? Suddenly, this islander, this most trusted servant, reappeared, and in his hand he had a beautiful shell, a gift for the man of the cloth. Now, the man of the cloth knew that this trusted servant had taken a long, dangerous journey in a dugout canoe to one of the uninhabited islands in this island group, where only those shells were found. A very special gift, but yet this best friend of his had put his life in danger. And so gratefully he accepted the shell, the gift. He said, but why, just as I was leaving, why did you take such a long, dangerous journey? And this simple islander said, the journey was part of the gift. And isn't that what the new person and what each of us bring to Alcoholics Anonymous? We've already had our long, dangerous journey of alcohol and drugs. And yet, unknowingly, we bring to Alcoholics Anonymous this loving, beautiful fellowship, that dangerous journey. It's part of our gift to Alcoholics Anonymous. And those of us who have been here for a while understand that long, dangerous journey. We say we love you for it. That's a precious gift. And the new person says, I don't understand. I do not understand. And we said what was said to me, keep coming until you understand. We have another way of living. We have a different journey, but we love you. We want you. Come join hands with us. And perhaps a new person says, but I'm so weak. I'm so frail. And then the first paradox of Alcoholics Anonymous is perhaps expressed to that person. Join your hands to ours and we will all be stronger. This beautiful fellowship's full of paradoxes. And that's the first. Join your hands with ours, you'll make us all stronger. Hang on to us. Stay in the middle. And I did, and you all did, and we're still doing it together. That's why we still welcome that new person. As I began to mature a bit in Alcoholics Anonymous, meaning that I began to understand a little better what you were sharing with me, one of the mysteries to me was why, and Buck encouraged me, find people in AA that you admire, that sort of your heroes and sheroes, and find out what they do. Get to know them. And I did. And you know, without fail, every one of the people in AA that I admired and still admire today go to lots of meetings. Whether they've been in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, or 1 year. Doesn't matter. They go to lots of meetings. And it was a mystery to me. Why? Why? I read in the big book, World War II, you know, people overseas, they did really well. Read the big book, stayed sober. I could stay in my little apartment after I was broken up with my 12, my big boy. I didn't have to go to meetings, right? Wrong. But still a mystery to me. And so I began to think, why? Why are these meetings? And suddenly it dawned on me, again, like one of the so many things in this program, simple, right in front of me. Only at meetings can this happen. When I go to a meeting, especially 12-step meetings or small groups around the circle, it's only in those meetings that I see what? Clearly. I see me. Me. When I go to meetings, it's just like looking in a mirror, in a looking glass. That new person whose deodorant has failed, that was me. That person has a good contented sobriety, and maybe they've just been sober a few months, but they've got it today that's working. That gives me that hope, that promise, that I can feel that right then or within a few hours or within a few days. I see people that have been around lots of years, and they still enjoy coming to meetings regularly and sharing, and I see what I can become. And I suddenly realize that image of Alcoholics Anonymous is true in my life as I hope it is in yours. The image of a giant mosaic called Alcoholics Anonymous, made up of all kinds and shapes and colors of stones. Each one of us has a place in that mosaic. Now most of us have seen a mosaic, perhaps some of you actually built or made or designed mosaics. And you know, if we have a mosaic on the wall and one of those stones falls out, our eyes are drawn instantly to that missing stone, that, as some would call, an imperfection. Now, our mosaic of Alcoholics Anonymous is made up of all of you and those who have gone before, but yet some of us choose to go back out. We take our stone, we leave. Some permanently, we hope not, but some for a while. Now, when that happens, do we take a new person's stone and put it in their place? No. We don't. We leave that spot empty. And we say, please come back and put your rightful stone in your rightful place in Alcoholics Anonymous. Some would say our mosaic is imperfect. They would say our mosaic of sobriety is not beautiful. I don't agree. I think this mosaic of sobriety, this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, is the most beautiful creation in the world. And it's a privilege to be part of it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Carlton. I especially like the fashion tips. Since I'm moving there. But wait, there's more. We have a couple more gifts to give out. We have tapes here. Two, are they the same tape?
No,
they're two different tapes. Okay. Tapes by Earl. And Earl's back there. For the first tape, we've taken the liberty of drawing in Connie Bring? Brian? Is Connie, is that you?
She's not here.
Okay, well, we all congratulate Connie on that. And then Ron W., who I know isn't here.
Hey.
He's somewhere else. He's also gotten the other tape, so anyway, great. One final note of appreciation. I just want to say Gene A. has done a wonderful job being the manager of the home, and he deserves a lot of credit for that.
Gene A.